So first things first, can you tell me what your names you already have said, where you were born, but then where your parents were also then born? And if you, yeah, you start there. So your names, where you were born, and then actually where were your parents born?
Well, we're sisters. My name's Naheed Ashraf.
I'm Azra Sayed.
We were both born in a hospital called Lydia Bainan by the Celtic Manor, which doesn't exist anymore. So born in Newport. Our parents were from the original India, which then partitioned in 1947. And we are from Pakistan, so there was a lot of movement around where mum and dad were actually based. Dad was originally from a place called Jumshare and then moved to Bahari, and then mum was from a place called Jarawala near Faisalabad in Pakistan.
What do you know of these areas your parents were born?
I visited quite a few times and had a look at the land that we used to own and where my father used to work on the land. We have family, our extended family is out there, our uncles and cousins, and I've been out there a number of times on both sides of the family, my father's side and my mother's side.
So when people came from India during the after the partition, most of them, majority, 99%, settled as landowners. So everyone owned a piece of land and they had to fend for themselves from that land, and that's how it worked. So mum and dad weren't related as such. They sort of only through marriage they became related. They weren't sort of cousins or anything like that you sometimes find. Yeah, my nanny and my Nana and everybody, they've all sort of brought up. Their mum came from a very, very large family. There were nine brothers and sisters, and they all came over. They were very lucky actually, as they came over as a family, and that's including my dad's family as well, where during the partition a lot of people lost a lot of family members due to what happened, but they were the lucky ones.
With the partition, our mum tells us that a lot of people of the family did, the elderly died on the way as they were partitioning into Pakistan and are buried somewhere in Pakistan, but the graves were never marked, so we will never know en route from India to Pakistan where our ancestors are buried en route when they were making their way into Pakistan, which is really sad. But we know that the land that they had in Pakistan, they grew corn, sugarcane, and wheat, and then they grew vegetables, and the vegetables were used then for cooking for food for the family.
Do you know about the social life back there? What games they played? What activities culturally? Do you know of any? Do you have any details on that?
Well, I think with dad, it was mainly being thrown into work from a very, very young age, and I think that happened with a lot of the men. Women, on the other hand, used to make up their own games. They'd sort of, mum tells us quite often, as little girl, that when they were very young, her and her friends would get together and they would make dolls and get them married. But they would actually carry out the whole wedding ceremony, make rice and make all the food, and they would actually have a wedding for the two dolls and those sort of things. Or play Ludo. Ludo was a very popular game then, so it wasn't like sort of. No phones or nothing then, or Xbox or anything like that. So it was, you had to make up things yourself. And we found that a lot of the men went to school, but a lot of the girls didn't go to school. They went to Islamic classes to learn the Quran, but they didn't all get taught in schools, which is quite sad, not as it is now.
Let's explore that then a little bit. So that's my next question about schooling. Do you know what kind of education they had?
The education system is very different
Yes.
to what we have here.
It was more like if you got to a certain level in school, so they had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. If you got to sort of like the fifth Jamaat, that was amazing, You were sort of, you could go on to do big things. So, as long as you sort of got the basics of everything, that was, you were good to go. But you can imagine coming over from another country, settling somewhere else. Teachers had to be found, schools had to be set up. It was a big thing. It was, you know.
They had no belongings because when they came from, when it partitioned, because there were riots between or both religions at that time, they describe, my mum describes her siblings being thrown into the water with a view of then rescuing them from the water to reunite. And then they came with basically what they were wearing, you know. They had no belongings.
Yeah.
So their main focus was to find land, farm, look after the family and find a way to survive, to eat.
Yeah, but they also, I know, I remember mum and dad telling me that because they had sisters, mum had sisters, you know, and because they were girls, they would travel through the night rather than the day so they wouldn't get sort of kidnapped and raped and stuff like that. So they had to travel through the night in sort of like, you know, through the grasslands and everything very, very quietly. And that's how they came across. Otherwise they would be captured and, you know, killed and things. And that happened to many, many families.
I mean, let's bring that back to yourself then. I mean, what was life like for you growing up here in Newport and your schooling? Talked about your parents there.
First generation Muslims to start schooling. So I remember right from a primary age, I think there was only one other person in the class that was of any colour, and you were very alien to people, and I think teachers had quite low expectations of you. Even though you were born in this country, you spoke English. Many without an accent, you were still seen as somehow inferior. I always felt that it's almost like your colour disqualified you from being British.
Yeah, you had to work really hard to get accepted, and even then you weren't really accepted. So through school, I didn't really experience any racism as such. But you still get the comments, the odd comments, and, you know.
People say racist slur and say, but not you.
But not you.
Because, you know,
yeah.
You're not like that, because they would be in the gang of friends that you had made.
Yeah.
But they would still then say it to other people. It's not like you, that, you know, you're different. Well, no, I'm not. I'm the same. You know, they'd question you about your food as well, wouldn't they?
Yeah,
or
definitely all the time.
What do you eat, and the way you dress, and... It was a struggle, and I think, you know, very much like when our parents came over, they didn't have the welcome that was promised. It wasn't the land of milk and honey that was promised to them. And I think that it's not far removed from that today when you look at education opportunities, when you look at how far people have come. It's almost like you have to be act white to be able to progress. And that was exactly what they had to do to try and integrate into the community, and it's been very challenging.
It has been
say.
Challenging, yeah.
What family traditions or celebrations do you remember from a young age that your parents kind of did with you, by you and for you? When did they arrive in the UK as well?
So in this, you know, I
Mum arrived
We've
in
We've got a whole section on that, but we'll just get context.
Mum came over around 1967.
Yeah.
Dad came.
Yeah, so Dad was here for 5 years. So he came in the 60s when they were asking for the labour force to come over here. And then Mum arrived. Then he went back to Pakistan after 5 years and then married my mum. And then they came over here.
And how long until you guys were born?
I was born the year after.
Okay, that's a good time to start then. Back to that question is, when they arrived, you guys started to appear.
Yeah.
What traditions do you remember from a very young age then? And cultural practices that were instilled upon you and around you?
Yeah.
What do you remember?
Well, obviously the obvious ones like Eid and everything. Well, that was a big thing. massive family get-togethers, because by then my uncles and aunts had arrived. My uncles had got married, and you know, so they were older than Mum, so they had already started their families, so they were slightly older than us. I think between our cousins there's about 10 years before we started appearing. So but they settled in Scotland, not here, so we didn't see them very often. It wasn't until they came over a few years later and settled in Cardiff, which is when we started big family gatherings. But it was mainly sort of the Muslim sort of traditions, I would say.
Yeah, so we've been brought up in a culture where we were toying with two cultures.
Yeah.
So when we were in school, we'd remember coming home and saying it's Christmas in school, and then having to say to, you know, that you know, our parents sort of trying to explain that festival was a Christian festival and what have you. But Dad was really keen for us to mix with different cultures and yeah. different religions and learn about each other. He really, really wanted to integrate into Britain. And Eid was lovely, especially, you know, Ramadan was lovely. You know, the abundance of food, you know, we didn't really understand it. You know, trying to fit into this society. My mum used to make us keep half a fast. She used to say we could eat at 12 o'clock. And so we used to keep a fast and then wake up and then eat at 12 o'clock and then think that we did something really amazing. It's only until we grew up we realised that mum was trying to sort of keep our religion intact and keep our cultures intact. And every weekend we had people in our house. Our house was always full of people.
Always.
So our parents progressed, you know, after working really hard, we ended up having businesses. And when we had businesses, our networks became even more bigger and bigger. And all I can remember is our house being full of people, us being in the kitchen just making teas and samosas. And, and because we're like, you know, it was just, but it was lovely. Everybody had time for one another.
Yeah. But I do remember, though, because we had a lot of English families in our streets. At Christmas, Mum and Dad would make give them presents, maybe if just chocolates or something.
Yeah.
They would always make an effort to go and give their families a gift at Christmas, even though it wasn't anything to do with us, you know. So, you know, so we felt sort of all together, because we had lovely neighbours in that street, and they were very, very helpful. They weren't sort of, you know, if Mum and Dad weren't home, they would say, you know, come to our house after school, have some tea, and then we'll drop you back off and things like that. They were very, very sort of, it was a lovely little community we lived in. It was really nice in those days.
But it wasn't always like that. So when we were very, very little, we had some neighbours who were very racist, and they would throw things into our garden. They would put the music on really loud. Mum and Dad were kind of felt like if they'd said something, then it would only be worse. So they tolerated it for a while, and then after a while, then whatever they threw over was being thrown back. Eventually, luckily for us, they moved, and a good family moved in. But Dad was always protective of us as well. I mean, those social occasions, we would always drive up to Rochdale, where we had family, and spend our holidays would be there. You know, they wouldn't be holidays abroad, or they would be going to Pakistan. We wouldn't have the holidays abroad as such as we do now.
But it did make you think back when Dad started working here on the railways, when he first came, when he was working in the factories first, he went on to work in the railways, and they gave him an English name.
Yeah.
And that always has stuck in my mind, like, he has a name which you can say quite perfectly why.
Or you could have shortened his name.
You could have shortened his name. So his name was Ashraf, Mohammed Ashraf, and they gave him an English name on the railways as Sam. So he was always known as Sam. Everyone knew him as Sam, and that's what they called him. And I always quite often thought, like, why? Why did they have the need to do that?
And I would quite often I'd always thought, even now, it really bothers me. I always think I want to go back to all the people that were working with him and ask them, you know, why did you do that? I know people, even in our generation today, that have English names at work because they're trying to fit in.
Do you know what was the reasoning for them to arrive in the UK? What was the motivations and reasoning?
came for work. They came to help rebuild Britain. They came because, my dad used to say, obviously, I'm here because they were there. But one day they will tell us to go back.
Yeah,
he did always used to say, we have to build something there. One day they will always tell us to go back because, you know, they just want us to do the work that the white people don't want to do. So he came to help rebuild Britain after the war.
Yeah, they suffered quite a lot with us growing up, in the fact that, you know, more than half of their earnings were sent back to help with the families back there so they could build something there, so there was always something there to go back to. And I think that was, we don't think like that now, but in that generation I think most parents did that, built something back home in the fear that they might say, well, you know, you can go now. You know, because of what they experienced in India, I think it was always there that might happen again. So when Dad was earning, Mum had to cope with, you know, those shillings that my dad was bringing home. Part of that had to be put away so they could send back. So even Mum started work then. So she started working from home, as a lot of the women did, where you used to sew clothes at home. So there'd be factories like for dresses or hospital wear or whatever, and they would come and give you a bundle, as they called them then, and it depended on you how many bundles you wanted that week. You'd sew them, maybe putting zips and buttons and whatever on them, and then they would pay Mum for that, and that happened a lot with all the, just so they were earning something to help, you know, help bring the children up and help the with bills and things. I remember it being...
My dad was earning £12 a week.
Yeah.
You know, and they were renting a room when they first came here.
Yeah.
And then Mum wanted to have her own house, so they saved and saved and saved and then bought a house. So it was £1,100 that they paid for the first house.
But in those days, the community would get together. So if you were going to buy a house, all the community would put their savings into your deposit to get the house and help you get on the housing ladder, and then when it came to their turn you would do the same for them, and that's how it worked, and that's why a lot of the families ended up with homes, not just renting, and that's how it worked then. So
what do you know about the work situation? You said the where he worked, where your father and your mother worked, you briefly explained that. What do you know about those working situations, and do you have any stories to tell them now?
Well, Dad was quite lucky because he got to grips with the language quite quickly, and because of that he made a few friends along the way, and because he just got on with things, although my dad was quite vocal, he still just got on with things. To him it was a job, he was earning money to, you know, to provide for his family. He sort of got promoted quite quickly.
Yeah, so he was with the railway industry, and it was the shunting the coal, so it was basically the coal, the trunks that came along with the coal in them, making sure that they were going to the right place. We didn't have to go into the coal mines because he was part of the railways. And
that was in Barry, Barry Port there. That's how it started. That's where he used to work.
Yeah.
So when an opening came in Newport, they offered it to my dad, which was great. So with a pay rise. So it sort of fell.
But they were long. They were long hours.
Oh yeah, very long
really
hours.
Long hours.
Very,
and
very long hours.
And you remember, sort of, Dad used to say when he first came here before Mum, before he married Mum, there were lots of Pakistani men living in the same room, even, and they used to take it in turns to cook. And it's almost like because they work shifts, there was never a bed empty. So the ones who would go in the daytime would give the night men the bed. And the bed was never empty because they would just kind of swap.
And food was very scarce as well.
Yeah.
So one of them would have to make the flour for the roti. The other one would make the curry. And they didn't have fridges in those days, so they had to cover it up and hide it somewhere cool. And then it was portioned for each of them. So whoever came home took their portion, and that was it. That's all you had for the day. You know, it was very, very tough times. They were really tough times. I remember Dad saying, and sometimes you would go sort of hungry, you know. But yeah, like you said, they used to have to share beds. So one would do a day shift, one would do a night, and they would swap with each other, and that's how they made it work. So until my granddad said, you need to come home and get married, you need a wife.
But then when they saved their money, he ended up buying, we ended up owning, going into the rag trade. So it was fashion in Kingsway Centre, and it was in the 80s, and business was thriving. We had a really good business, didn't we? Mum then gave up work of what she was doing, all the efforts were put into the shop. And in those days, the whole family would be there, so children used to even go into the shops then to, you know, be part of, you don't see that these days, but, you know, be part of the people that serve, you know, the weekends on a Saturday or after school. And life changed when Dad had his own business, and because that was what was going to make him enough money to be able to support his family here and to support the family there in a good way.
I mean, during those times, what did they speak of back home? What was their connection back home, and how often did they go back, and did they make any efforts to... It sounds like they were, at that point, focusing a lot of energies here.
Well, the form of communication was telegrams.
First, yeah.
So that's how they communicated. You'd send something and it wouldn't get there till about 6 to 8 weeks later. And the same from them when they were sending something. Unless somebody was travelling, then they would give them a letter and say, can you give this to my son or my daughter? Yeah. And you were from the same village. But if not, then that's how they communicated, through a telegram. There was quite often somebody had been born or somebody had passed away, and you wouldn't find out till about 2 months later because of the telegram. So that was very, very hard. And I know my dad really missed his mum and dad.
Well, that's the first time I ever saw Dad cry, is when we had the telegram that his mum had died.
Yeah.
The first and probably last time that I ever saw him.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking,
That was really hard.
Yeah, but he was lucky enough to bring them over here and take them to Hajj as well. So he did, when he had the opportunity and the funds, he did call my grandparents here and they stayed a while. So I think that was something he felt like such a big achievement there, didn't he, that he was managed to get them here and then take them to Mecca. It was,
sometimes they used to go together, and it was a bit more difficult for us with being in school and whatever, and sometimes they would take it in turns to go, so they always kept that connection with Pakistan.
Yeah, so every few years, it wouldn't be every year, but every few years one of them or both would go.
What did they speak of as their early experiences in the UK?
Cold. Wet, food was different, they felt isolated. You know, that's why you find within our communities why they're all so together. So you go down a street and it's mainly Asian, because in those days you couldn't fit anywhere else. Where were you supposed to go? You know,
everybody became everyone's support network from your own communities, which is why they all try to live together.
To keep near each other, so they always have that there,
It was, you know...
And you didn't have a car, so anything you wanted to go to get, like Mum would have to, you know, take us all with her to go to the Saturday market, get all the fruit and the veg or any groceries that they needed, and then she'd walk there and walk back again, because you didn't have any other form of, sort of transport then. So that was difficult. She said, you know, it was really, really hard, whether it was snowing, or we used to have a lot of snow and rain, we still have a lot of rain, but there, those days we had to have really heavy snow. And she said she'd still have to go out, so she'd sometimes leave us at home, don't move, you're in one room, that sort of thing, because in those days it wasn't as strict as it is now. And she would have to quickly go early in the morning, get her shop and get back again to us, and, you know, and her heart would be all over the place thinking that she's left us, you know, and really, really difficult times.
Yeah. You couldn't get halal food. Yeah. So I remember one day my dad bringing home some chickens, they were live chickens running around the room, and he took them out the back to halal them just so we could have chicken. And so, you know, it's not like it was now. But even then, there wasn't, like, you'd get halal restaurants and stuff. Even going out was really hard, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You couldn't sit somewhere and eat. There was nowhere for you to go. So you're restricted in a lot of ways in integrating. Yeah. There was no mosque, so my father was one of the founders of the Jamia Mosque in Commercial Road in Newport, and helped build, obviously, the foundations of the structure. So just before he died, he managed to get the structure ready there. And it was like that for years afterwards then, because obviously the committee had disbanded at that time, after that. And people who are from Newport remember a metal structure, a foundation, steel structure, yeah, still being there for years and years and years until it's now built into the rest of the mosque. But yeah, he was very...
He's really active in that, wasn't he?
He was a businessman, and he used that to his advantage in the sense of creating that cohesion. He was involved in so many things. He was involved in magistrates, the home safety committees. He introduced halal food to our health board in Newport. He was on so many different committees and all sorts, because he really believed that despite what colour, race, religion you were, whatever your background was, everybody should be live in harmony. He really believed that that's what we could do and that's what we could achieve if we just all tolerated each other's religions.
We've kind of talked about these things, haven't we? Customs and traditions. As you guys have gone older, what customs and traditions have you maintained that your families offered you at a young age, if any?
We still... The children in the family have been brought up in the same way. They still go to mosque when they're small, to learn about the religion. We still have... We still do Ramadan, we still do our Eids. We've kept united as a family in terms of the extended family. My brothers still live with my mum and their families, so they still live in a extended family because they're our support networks, having that. So,
why have you preserved these particular traditions and customs? Why are they meaningful to you?
I think mainly because Mum was left on her own. She's quite
widowed.
Young. Widowed when she was quite young. So we felt very protective of her, and my brothers felt very protective of her. So there will come a time, well, obviously, when as their families grow, things will change. And Mum or none of us have a problem with that. But at the moment, Mum, we all feel Mum needs to be surrounded by that. She's done so much for us. And it's our only way to give back. We see Mum all the time, my brothers live there, so she's always looked after, and I think it just became a priority within the family. Yeah,
as well, I think, is to maintain our sense of identity as well, because I, for example, never used to wear, I've been to Umrah twice, and on and off I wore a scarf, but I never really did at work because I felt like I should be trying to fit in. And one day I thought, no, I've lost my identity trying to fit in with the society. I'm not going to do that anymore. And I started wearing a scarf to work and was very surprised by that reaction from a lot of people. People were almost not able to speak to me, even until I had to say, my brain hasn't changed because I have a scarf on my head. And I found that quite eye-opening, because when I wasn't wearing it, I think people felt that I was more like them. And now I am wearing it, I look different. So I think maintaining your identity in terms of culture and in terms of religion is very important. I mean, religion's always played a really big factor in our house, particularly, we read regularly, we have get-togethers where we read the Quran, just, as a family, for my dad. We maintain as much religion, and we keep on learning. And, the internet is a great thing for the kids these days to learn more, but we were taught the Quran when we were here, when we were young. We were just taught how to read it, so we can read Arabic from the Quran, but we can't understand it, so we don't know what we're reading, but we're reading it. And so, you know, it's a bit different now. There's more knowledge out there of transliteration and stuff.
And the way the world is changing so fast, it's so fast-paced at the moment. I think it's really important for the next generation, the youngsters now, to keep that family unit, for them to understand. So when they're all together, that culture's still there. I think the minute you start sort of disbanding and going your own way, I think things start to change. So they have their limits, they know what's right and what's wrong, but I think it's really important for them to understand where they came from and where they need, which way, route they need to take.
I think there was always a fear from all people that came from Pakistan that the children that grew up here would become too westernised and would lose their way, would lose their religion, would lose their values. You know, people here, they dress differently, you know, they, you know, that even going to the cinema was such a big thing when we were young, you know, it was, you know, why would you want to go to a cinema, you know, it's, when you can, you know, watch things at home, and it was that fear, I think, that, that, you know, they might lose their way.
Yeah.
You know, how do we hold on to that religion and that culture? Yeah. But I found over time that there's been a dip and there's been a peak, hasn't there? Because all of a sudden, everybody is moving towards Islamic religion in a real big way and finding out more about it, learning more about it, learning that Islam actually means peace, you know, and learning how to live in a more tolerated society. Whereas, you know, there was a time, was it, when everybody was trying to find your way, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, even if we wanted to go to a restaurant, Mum would say, well, why can't you cook at home?
Yeah.
Don't you need to pay to go to eat? I don't understand.
Yeah.
What traditions or cultural practices have you possibly even adapted or updated, do you feel, as being another generation? Because I think that tends to happen a bit, and you just make, you know, you have cottage pie for iftar or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly. Well, obviously,
the chili and my lasagna.
I think the food definitely has, because the young, and it's good for them, because they can't just, they need to fit into society, and be able to socialise in a confident way.
But can you remember us when we were younger that Dad used to love foods from different countries, so he'd come home and we used to have on a Sunday, on a Saturday we used to have like javel, so we'd have rice, all the traditional curries and everything, and on a Sunday would be roast dinner, and we would have a roast dinner in the same way with no spices, it was just all like a proper chicken roast with all the vegetables and everything, and our friends who are Pakistani used to say they'd have an English dinner in their house. Because they saw that as an English dinner, that, and I used to say it's the same food, it's just cooked in a different way, and they just couldn't understand. Yeah. And even to this day, and you know, this generation's on now, when we're talking about, oh, what you're cooking today, in our house they still say, oh, we're making English dinner, because it's in
their heads, that's how they used to call it. But the menu as such has changed, because the kids want to eat differently, so, you know, there's pastas and Italian and pizzas and, you know, you name food, food has totally changed.
But clothing, the way we dress has changed as well, because when we were younger, it was always seen as you would wear, you know, clothes that were traditional. Even if you were out, you know, you would wear the traditional dress. And my father was a little bit more liberal. As long as we were covered, you know, he didn't mind sort of, you know, what their tops and trousers looked like. And, you know, we even had people from the community, didn't we, ringing home and saying,
I saw your daughter. Trousers and a top on, jeans and a top on. Where's she going? And it's like...
And, you know, and my parents would say, well, she went from home like that.
Yeah, so she's going to come home like that.
Well, you know, people, they used to actually go out to the house and then change their clothes...
Just to fit in
in society, and then rechange to come home.
Yeah.
You know, just so they feel like they were missing out on something.
Yeah. So this generation are very lucky, because everything is so much more liberal with them. you know.
We were brought up with the attitude, look, you've got to save, because you have to save your money to make sure that you have a better life for yourself. You know, you need to buy your own houses.
Yeah.
You need to, you know, make sure that you have enough to live on, you know, don't live off the state, work hard. You know, we had a really strong work ethic.
But that's because of the struggles that they had faced, that they'd come through. Obviously, they were always going to, you know.
But I find that's different with the children that are born now. I find that everything that people didn't have is given to them on a plate.
There's definitely a change, you know. They want to go out all the time, they want to eat out all the time, you know.
I remember
iced coffees and thing. It's a daily thing. It's not like a treat anymore. Yeah. For us, when we were growing up, that would be something you'd save for, and then you'd have a treat. But now it's like, oh, I'm just going for a coffee, or I'm just going out and go for lunch. You know, it's totally different, isn't it? But
and they don't, you know, and it was different in terms of the housework and everything, because we didn't have microwaves, we didn't have washing machines. I remember Mum washing by hand, and I remember Mum using towels for nappy, they were nappy, the nappies, the traditional nappies, and having to wash them and hang them on the thing. Everybody used
all
them, they didn't have
them,
disposable
yeah.
ones then.
And now it's so easy.
And I can remember Dad having the first colour television and thinking, oh wow, and it was all those like lines on there, and that one sitting there, like.
and Dad was the first person in the community to have a car.
Yeah, in our street.
Which was such a massive thing.
So he had a brown Humber.
Humber Sector.
Yeah. Mm. Humber Sector. Yeah.
Have you got any heirlooms or mementos or ornaments that remind you of your parents' upbringing?
So I have got, so back in the day when my mum got married, traditionally they still do it now, but they used to give a big chest, and in that chest there would be plates and rugs and crochet, hand crocheted, you know, pillowcases and things like that. So from my mum's chest, I have her, what they gave her was, it's called a lota, but basically it's what they use to clean themselves in the bathroom. So when people use jugs and things these days, so it's a bit like a bidet, but it's it looks, I don't know how to describe it, but it looks like a measuring jug with a little spout on it, basically. But it's quite intricate because obviously it was given to her when she got married, so
and it's just been in the case,
kind of engraved, you know, it's quite posh, if you like. So it's never been used, it's just you know, so I've got that. And I've also got a little from my granddad when he came for the first time. They didn't have what's called a hookah, which is like a smoking pipe, which they use in shisha bars these days. So he made one out of like a little bottle and a top, and wrapped it up and whatever, and it's got a little spout and everything. So I have that as well. And don't have any heirlooms, but I do have some of Dad's clothes still, like his suits. My dad was very suited and booted, he was a very smart man. And so I still have one of his suits.
Yeah,
and it still smells of my dad. So,
yeah. I've just got like a mum's, you know, the surma that they put in the eyes, the liner, the coal. They used to keep it in like sort of like silver little trinket pots then. So I've got that. I've kept that for many, 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 many years. So I've got that.
And I think, don't you still have them? The first grand sheaf that was given to you by Mum.
Yes.
Do you still have that?
I still have my grand.
Yeah. So it is a little bit worn, but
yeah,
it's like.
I read my gran when I was six, so I've had it since I was 6 years old.
Yeah.
So
and that was passed on. Yeah. It's one of those that's been passed on. Yeah.
Well, the reason I ask is amongst the people's collection, we can digitise heirlooms if you want them to be. So photographs can be scanned and restored. Tapes can be restored. If you have ornaments, they can be photographed. If you want those to exist in another format, so that's up to you. When that moment comes.
I've got a case of Dad's cassettes, but I don't know what's on them because I haven't got a cassette player. So
they're kind of stuff that people's collections.
There's things in there that probably
need to.
There's a cassette somewhere with Dad's voice in it, and I don't know where it is.
Yeah.
So at this point, I mean, I've got one last question, but that's going to be about Age Alive.
Okay.
I think this is over to you now. If there's things you've not mentioned that you definitely want to get on file, now's the chance to speak them. So you went through a kind of chronological order of, you know, originally India to Pakistan to migrating to arriving to working, and then customs and traditions that you kind of maintain. Is there things that you feel you want to add at this point? And if you want me to ask a question to trigger it, and say,
yeah,
I'll do that.
Yeah. I mean, you probably don't need to know this because this is just a little bit of the history that, you know, one of the things I probably would have liked to mention that, you know, Dad left his whole life behind, his family and everybody. And, you know, but this wasn't the first time that Pakistan had helped Britain because, in World War One, like 400,000 Indians came over here to fight in the war, and many Pakistanis and Indians died alongside British troops in that war. And I think that's often forgotten, that this wasn't the first time Pakistan came to the aid of, you know, it was India then, so the people from the Indian subcontinent at that time came over here. So I think sometimes people forget that there's like a history of people coming here to help Britain. It wasn't just, you know, the 1947, August 1947 partition.
I'll ask that as a question. So, I mean, from your perspective, just based loosely around what you just said, is what, at what scales do people need to be aware of how integration and migration has benefited the country? Mm. I don't know where you want to display that, really. You can talk about that if you want to. Read it out, it's up to you.
Okay. If I just, because you're going to edit it anyway, aren't you? I mean, I've already said the part where Dad was very perceptive and told us stories about Britain and his experience. He used to say, we are here because they were there, and one day they will tell us we don't belong. And at that time, we thought he was being humorous because my father was a really, really funny man. But, you know, unfortunately, some of those things ring true for us today. And the partition in India saw the end of a 200-year British rule. But I'm not sure if people know, but the British Pakistani community is one of the oldest and the largest ethnic minority community outside of Pakistan here. The UK's open-door immigration policy, they allowed members of the Commonwealth to apply here, but that was for Britain's post-war labour needs, being promised the land of milk and honey, leaving everything behind. But pre-partition, everyone lived in India, and there was 400,000 Indian soldiers fought for Britain in World War One. Many Pakistanis and Indians fought and died alongside British troops. So Great Britain coming here was not so great. The reception for the Pakistanis was far from welcoming. And I worry about that today because we see people coming into the country today, and even today, certain communities are welcomed more than others. Particularly, you know, in the recent Ukrainian crisis, for example, you know, that wasn't like the Afghan crisis where we had actually gone from Britain and interfered in people's lives. This was something else that had happened, but the welcome the Ukrainians received here, the support they received, the ability to work, which is very different from asylum seekers and refugees that come from other countries. But it was a far cry from Pakistani society where they lived in tight family units. Generations resided together, and there was a fundamental support network. It wasn't easy for first generation immigrants, and racism was widespread. They didn't look the same. The colour of our skin, our language, religion and culture became a problem for many. My father realised the colour of his skin somehow disqualified him from being British. And he couldn't understand that. He'd come from an Islamic religion which instructs Muslims to wholeheartedly help the needy, the destitute without considering colour, creed, race or religion. The weather here was cold, and the food was unfamiliar, unappetising and not in accordance with cultural and religious requirements. In the mid-60s, discrimination of skin colour became illegal, but on the other hand, there was an increasing concern over rising immigration, and the government imposed a series of immigration acts which effectively ended migration into Britain from the Indian subcontinent, but that included the Caribbean as well. So the black and South Asian people that come here did feel that they were under attack. So the country that they voluntarily had come here and they were asked to come and rebuild, turned their back on them. That affected hundreds and thousands of immigrants, but they settled here. They filled manual jobs and steel mill jobs and textile industry jobs, and for dads, like we said, it was the railways. Yeah. He was only 18 when he came here. We've spoken about him, the way he lived in one house, and how the bed, how they used to share the beds, and how determined he was really to make a good life of himself. About him buying his house. So he co-founded the Gwent Community Relations. So in 1984, he co-founded the Gwent Community Relations Council. That was in Newport. And he became an executive member. And he was representative on the Home Safety Committee, with local authorities, with the police, magistrates, and obviously all the work that he did with the Jamia Mosque and the halal food, thank goodness, that he introduced in the health board, which, you know, with dietary requirements that help you to recover better. There was nothing, people just sometimes wouldn't eat, they'd go to hospital, there was nothing for them to eat. And, apart from mashed potato. So that was a real turning point. But he was a modest man, and many of his contributions were done silently. So he helped a lot of people in the community, and it's only after his death that people would say, he helped bury my daughter, he helped me buy a car when my car wasn't, he gave me money when I was struggling. He helped so many people to the extent that when he died, some of his friends refused to ever travel the road he lived in again because he just wasn't there. There were thousands and thousands of people at his funeral. They had to close the streets. The funeral processions took place here in Dewsbury, in London, and right across Pakistan as well. So he's remembered by both young and old as an inspirational, happy and kind family man who always helped, mentor and guided so many people. He was always there, never missed a funeral or a wedding. He was always there at funerals, he always helped bury every person that died, he never ever missed it. And treated everyone as his own, nothing was too much trouble. And even to this day, both young and old will say, he was my friend. And it's only last week I was at a funeral and quite a young person actually said, he was my friend. And even to this day, it's been 29 years on the 20th of August. And even to this day, people still remember my father. When I think about my upbringing and what I love about, I think of all that despite all the struggles and the racism experienced, we were brought up in a loving family, advocates for togetherness and peace. We were taught to respect and be inspired by all religions and cultures and create bonds. Always remember the overabundance of food and being surrounded by lots of people. And I think of the values of my faith and how my parents taught me how to be honest, to love, be kind and generous. They're the values that our parents passed on to us due to all his hard work and sacrifices and my mother's. My dad said, we are here because they were there and one day they will tell us we don't belong. Your children, Dad, will say, we are here, Dad, because you are here and we will continue your legacy to help us belong.
Thank you very much. I mean, my next question is just going to be about Age Alive and how did you get involved with Age Alive?
This is a funny story. You can tell this story.
Well, for a number of years, pre-COVID, we kept saying that we wanted to join something. And all the groups seemed to be older and, you know, or they weren't sort of like, because we both work, they just weren't suitable for the date times and dates of work and whatever. So we kept saying to each other, oh, it'd be really nice to do something, a hobby of something, let's do something together. Anyway, so one of my friends said, why don't you join a group called Coffee and Laughs? So we sort of said, oh, should we go along and just see what it's about? So let's go and have a little chit chat with them and just see if we fit in or if it's something we want to do or don't want to do.
They were looking for donations and you had found loads for, they've got a group there called Baby Bundles.
Yeah.
And you had lots of like dummies and baby bottles. And
I'd gone somewhere and they had these things on offer and I bought them and think, well, I need to donate them now. Where do I donate them? And then I got in touch with Ingrid Wilson and she said, well, we run a baby bundle, why don't you come along and bring them on the same day with you? And that's how it started. So we went there and we just took to it. They took to us and we took to them.
It was really funny because a lot of them are older than us, even though everybody's over 50, I think, now, aren't they?
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, I kept saying, I can't think of anything worse. You know what I mean? Like, you know, that was my original. But when we actually got there,
they took it to us quite straight away. It was just like, they really were so welcoming. And we thought, right, okay, this might be something that we want to do. And then a few weeks later, we walked in and they were having a reshuffle within the group because some of the sort of founders of it now want to pass things down, pass some responsibilities down. So I walked in and they said, oh, there she is. And I said, oh, what have I done? And they said, oh, you're going to be the new chair of Coffee and Laughs. And I said, am I? And they all said, yeah, before you walked in, we all voted you in, so it's got to be you. So I'm now the chair of Coffee and Laughs and have been for quite a while now. So that's how we got involved in that group. And that came alongside Age Alive, because that's another group in Newport, which most of the members of Age Alive are part of Coffee and Laughs as well. So that's how we got involved with both of the groups, and we've done many things with Age Alive and been invited to some Windrush songs with them. So that's how that came about.
So. What do you feel is the importance of projects like Age Alive and Coffee and Laughs?
Oh, it's just the coming together of people who would not necessarily have anything else to do. It sort of takes away that loneliness. A lot of the ladies there have lost partners. They're not in family groups. You know, they are on their own. They're all from different backgrounds. So it just brings them together and gives them a bit of a light to look towards things. You know, they've got events to look forward to. They know they have to get up and get dressed and look nice and go out and meet other people. And it gives them that sort of life again, you know, where they've just been stuck at home doing nothing, especially during COVID. That was awful. So this is like, it's their little getaway, you know, which they wouldn't necessarily do or know how to do.
I think it teaches them as well a greater awareness. It gives them more skills. It gives them opportunities to try new activities that they perhaps hadn't grown up with trying. So, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like if someone said, oh, you know, do you want to learn a bit of flower arrangement? Or, you know, do you want to see where we were? They're just things you just didn't do.
Yeah.
So it's like anything, if you don't try, you don't know if you enjoy it. And so, I think this is a way of them not only trying new things, but to having those skills and maybe then carrying that on if it's something that they enjoy doing. And without these kinds of groups, unfortunately, you know, so I think I've seen lots of groups over many years set up and fall, the reason for that is because of the funding. People just don't have the funding to carry on with groups. It does, you know, it gets people learning about each other's cultures.
And it's about the confidence as well. You see some of them who were very, very quiet in the beginning when I first started, and they've just, you know, they're so confident now. They're vocal, they'll say what they want to say, you know, they sort of like get involved in so much more. Mm-hmm. And we do so much, we organise different sessions for them, whether it's yoga, whether it's making something, whether it's sort of all to do with health and well-being. And they're not shy to sort of talk about their problems in front of other people. They enjoy that, don't they, to get other people's take on what they might be going through. They don't feel like they're the only ones that are going through something. There are others like them, and that's a big thing for them.
It's been a massive contribution to helping towards people's mental health and well-being.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. But, you know, we can only go to the groups. We don't come to Age Alive every week. I mean, the reason we both work, we're both professionals, we both work. So everything that we do voluntarily, we do in between. So we volunteer with lots of different things.
Yeah.
We volunteer, we do a lot of work in the mosques, right across the Gwent, really. You know, we've been involved in setting up, looking at new mosques in areas where there aren't mosques. You know, open days for women and lots of things. So we get involved in things, but we do it, they're extra voluntary activities outside our normal everyday work.
Is there anything else you would like to add on record at all? I mean, I've done my questions.
Do you want to know what we do for a living, or that doesn't
really probably not bad?
You can do.
Because I just thought like that's what our parents did. I don't know.
You kind of be
like, I don't
think it's relevant. It's an oral history project, so I think modern day, current history. Maybe in about 10, 15 years, you can come back next stage, you can talk about where you've gone to. I think we've got plenty there. That was exactly an hour.
Was it really?
One minute under an hour.
Yeah. We didn't know what we wanted, so we kind of guessed.
We were in the car saying, I'm not really sure what this is about.
I said to her, funny enough, I typed up